Good afternoon, everybody. So the guy was here. Is that fine? Where's the guy? I don't tend to need a microphone anyway. Yeah, okay. All right. Thank you so much for your presence. I'm very happy to be here to play this quite modest role on the panel, and that is to introduce my dear friends and colleagues, Barbara Savage and Farrah Griffin and Corey Field. And I'm assuming, is that all right, Corey, because I'm taking my instructions from you, that perhaps we can speak in the order, this order, Farrah, Barbara, and where are you, Corey?
Right after me.
But Corey, you didn't give me your things.
Can I give you a bio?
You did?
Yes. I can introduce myself.
Oh, I'm very sorry. Corey sent me. She was very kind to send me the bios, and I printed them out. And anyway, all right. My apologies up front. Let us introduce first. Here you are, Corey. I'm sorry. It's Farrah who's missing. Hold on a minute. I'm good.
Farrah needs no introduction.
Yeah. Farrah needs no introduction.
A legend in her own.
I have to introduce Farrah. I will not be happy if I don't introduce Farrah.
Can you introduce yourself?
Oh, yes, I can. I'm Deborah McDowell. Deborah McDowell, I teach in the English department here. And I direct the Carter G. Woodson Institute. And I am typically far more organized than this. I had a series of meetings, printed out the bios, and I thought they were all here because it would just be a matter of reading. And that is something that I can do without difficulty. Corinne Feel, here we are. Again, my sincere apologies. Now I don't need my glasses for this. Yeah, I was right. It wasn't here. That's okay. It's okay. Yeah,
it's in the back of the book here.
Yeah, and I virtually know Farrah is. I don't know the title of your chair, the justly deserved chair. I know enough about you to introduce you in my sleep, but okay, exactly. Farrah is the William Ransford Professor of English and Comparative Literature and African American Studies at Columbia University. She is the author of the justly acclaimed Who Set You Flowing? The African American Migration Narrative in 1995, and If You Can't Be Free, Be a Mystery, In Search of Billie Holiday. I've always loved that title, and the book more so. And co-author with Celine Washington of Clawing at the Limits of Cool, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and the Greatest Jazz Collaboration Ever. Her most recent book, Harlem Nocturne, Women Artists and Progressive Politics During World War II, was published in 2013. In 2014, Griffin wrote the book for Jerry Allen's A Conversation with Mary Lou Williams, which premiered at Harlem Stage in March 2014. And I want to insert here, I attended that premiere in Harlem. It was absolutely fantabulous. What Farrah had done with the lyrics, the writing, the presentation was a very, very memorable evening, which we then, most of us, capped off at Shade Josephine's at a late night dinner where I, after two glasses of wine, sang Autumn Leaves at the piano bar. So my great pleasure to introduce Farrah. Barbara is my witness because she was there.
And she was marvelous.
Oh, Barbara. So, Farrah, you go ahead and then I'll introduce Barbara.
Thank you. I'm honored to have inspired your creative moment. Thank you all so much for joining us today to talk about this volume. I'll use my time to share with you some background on how the volume came to be, and then some thoughts on the form that it eventually took. So the volume, not even before we thought of it as a volume, four editors, over dinner were talking. We talked about black women's intellectuals and black women's intellectual labor and how invisible it was. It wasn't on syllabi. It wasn't in collections of essays. It wasn't apparent even in courses on black intellectuals or on women intellectuals, and certainly not on what's conventionally known as intellectual history. And it was really starting out as a kind of lament, right? But one of the things we thought was, well, why don't we do something about that? And before thinking about a volume, we thought about a project that would be collaborative and that we'd bring together groups of people to actually talk about the possibility. You know, why was this the case when we knew through our own work and through our own reading that there had been a number of black women thinkers since the beginning of the nation, and yet they weren't known, their contributions to thought and culture weren't known, as well known as we would have liked them to be. So we had a meeting where we invited a number of people who, and this is the important part, people who were already working on individual African-American women, not just African-American, but women of African descent throughout the diaspora. And we invited them to come. They'd either done this in books or articles. Some of them had been our mentors. We invited someone like Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham from Harvard University, who'd written a book on Baptist women. And we also invited the historian Gerald Horn, who at the time had recently published a book on Shirley Graham Du Bois, who's W.E.B. Du Bois's wife, but was an important thinker and activist in her own right. And we also invited younger people, including at that time people who were just finishing their dissertations, who we heard through the grapevine, were also working on black women intellectuals. And we just had a meeting come together that we somehow managed to fund. I still don't know how we did it, magic. come together and have a conversation about whether or not this would be a worthwhile endeavor. And everyone agreed that it would be. And then we started running into some glitches that could have stopped the project, but actually I think were evidence, more evidence of what it was we were talking about, the kind of absence that we were talking about. We applied for funding for a working group from the places you normally apply for funding, like the NEH and things like that. And I really think the idea of a collaborative project focusing on black women thinkers was so foreign that funders couldn't even imagine it, right? And all the work that we did, they couldn't imagine it. So the formal ways that we went about trying to get funded for this, the ways that academics ordinarily do, we were rejected. And we were a little despondent about that, but not enough to stop. And in fact, you know, when you work on peoples who have been marginalized, whomever those people are, you know that part of your responsibility is to kind of open the door, educate people about the importance, and that work, in spite of all the work that people who came before us had been doing, it still hadn't really changed structures, right? And so we decided, okay, well, then how can we do this? How can we're not going to get kind of a big, wide, highly respected grant to do this. How can we do this? And fortunately, we were all at institutions that supported our individual research, and, you know, institutions that were very supportive of kind of innovative intellectual projects, no matter what. Like, let's just see what happens. And we decided to use those resources rather than make this something that one institution could claim. We each decided to go to our own institutions, use our own research funds, raise money on our own campuses, and create a working group. And that's what we did. And the working group met over a period of 3 years. I should say that it was a working group. We were very conscious about wanting it to be international, interracial, and mostly, and I would say, across gender lines, but most importantly, intergenerational, because we also saw it as an opportunity for senior scholars to be informed by the work of younger scholars, for younger scholars to be mentored by senior scholars, to be in the same room and have attention given to their work. And that's what we were able to do. We met over a period of 3 years where we workshopped each of the chapters that eventually appear in the volume. And so we got to see them at their very early stage, sometimes at their outline stage. And everyone got attention given to their work across disciplinary boundaries and institutional settings. We held those meetings at our universities, University of Pennsylvania, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and Columbia University. And we also decided that we thought we'd like to open the door. So even though this was a collaborative project with a number of scholars across all those lines that I'm talking about, we also knew that it was still a very small group. And so at the culmination of that 3 years, we hosted an international conference and invited people, like, if you're in the boondocks, if you're by yourself somewhere, if you're just working lonely in a lonely way on this thing that we're calling intellectual history of black women, won't you come and share your work with us? And we will fund it, we will get you there, and all you have to do is come be in community with us and share your work. So the culmination, the first culmination, if there can be more than one, was this international conference, and the second was the volume that we're here to talk about today. And then I'll just tell you a little bit about some thoughts that I have about the volume, except to say that working on this was probably one of the richest experiences of my professional intellectual life. I mean, I realized that, you know, I gained so much working in collaboration, working in community. My work gained so much, but also my person gained so much. And intellectual collaboration is not the primary model for those of us who work in the academy, especially those of us who work in the humanities. I mean, we really are kind of, you know, it can be both a very satisfying pursuit, but at times a very lonely pursuit. And this felt satisfying without being lonely. I mean, you were responsible for the words on the page, but you were producing it in community. The volume produced a series of conversations that I think are even ongoing beyond it, like this conversation that we're having now. And I think it's not insignificant that that spirit of collaboration, I hope, is evident in the fact that this is not a monograph, but a collection of essays, right? That it's an anthology rather than a singular monograph. It joins... In that way, it actually joins what I realize is a kind of informal literary tradition in the field of both African-American studies, but especially black women's studies. And one of the first books that was really important in carving out space in this way is, I hope you all have been able to hear me because I just realized that I could hear a little better when I talk into the microphone. So that one of the first volumes is the Black Woman, with some of you may be familiar with that volume, published in 1970. And it's not as obvious, but our volume pays homage to that volume because the original one, the second, the new edition, has a picture, beautiful picture, of its editor, Tony K. Bambara, on the cover. But that original cover was very striking because it had a kind of singular, anonymous face photograph of an African-American woman, a black woman, with an afro that blended into the dark background. Mm-hmm. And on the side, it said, "The Black Woman," right? And so we sort of pay homage to that in our cover with the actual, you know, the figure that we use on the cover. And then some things have changed, so we couldn't really get away with writing anything called the or the Black Woman today, because we know there is no such thing as the one Black woman, right? So so in that way, it looks both backward and forward. But that anthology, which was not an academic book, but included academic work in it, was one of the first texts, kind of text that signals, okay, these women have something to say, and the subjects about which they write have something to say. The second volume, where you start to get actually an academic field, you know, where academic fields begin to pay attention, start to come out in the 1980s. And again, the sort of most influential ones are, again, anthologies and collections. So one of them has that extraordinary title, All the Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave, which was published in 1982 and actually contained a number of important essays that are kind of founding texts of the field. And then in 1983, the year following that, there was a volume called Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology. And you can already see the ways that things are changing. So we start off with the black woman, and many of the women that are written about in that text are not feminists, and in fact are kind of writing against a black, against a women's liberation model, right? And by the time you get to Homegirls, it's a black feminist anthology. And so, you know, at the beginning of the field, before people writing, and this is an important, I'm not saying black women writing about black women, I'm talking about all peoples writing about black women. Before one could begin to get tenure writing a book about an African-American woman thinker, before there is some legitimacy, academic legitimacy to doing the work, these anthologies were the form that that work took, right? And it traveled in anthologies. So in that way, I think our book looks back to that tradition, builds upon that tradition, but also, you know, and walks, you know, if that tradition lays a kind of foundation for our anthology, I think we walk upon a path, our volume walks upon a path that's forged by those women over 30 years of work by scholars about African-American women. So we weren't just, you know, like Topsy, born without parents, right? Just popping out of somewhere, right? Or I should say like Athena popping from Zeus's head, right? That's not who we were, that we really did walk on a path that was forged before us, and we try to acknowledge that. And then we also try to open up some conversations, and those conversations include conversations with people who intellectually, when they think of an intellectual tradition, do not think of black women as participating in it. And this is a way to say, oh, that's just because you don't know. Like, we're not hitting you in the head, even though you deserve to be hit in the head. It's just because you don't know. And here's a volume full of them and a way to think about them across nation, right, and through time. And so that's one of the things that we wanted to do. And also, I think it was important because, as Hazel Carby has reminded us, even popular representations of black intellectuals, who gets to be called a black public intellectual, still doesn't often include black women thinkers, even though the language of black women thinkers informs and shapes our public discourse, most people don't know that at all. And so this was a way to try and intervene there. And then I'll close by saying that an important thing that we learned as we wrote, you know, these individual essays and workshopped them was that these thinkers were thinkers in their time. They engaged the ideas of their time, and they offered something to that conversation. If you think of Phyllis Wheatley, who's just a girl when she begins, and we have a beautiful essay on Phyllis Wheatley as a kind of transnational public intellectual. That's a very different way of thinking about her versus the little girl with the bonnet, right? But she was engaging Enlightenment ideas, and she was participating as a girl in salons in Boston where ideas about the American Revolution were circulating. Absolutely. And she was contributing to those ideas and daring to write to George Washington about them, right? And so they are engaging the ideas of their time. Finally, I think the volume asks us to rethink who can be an intellectual, right? Does it mean you have to be university educated? What kind of work constitutes intellectual work? There are ideas behind our movements, right? There are ideas behind sermons, right? So who gets to be an intellectual? What constitutes intellectual work? Where are these ideas communicated? Changing the source of where we look for them. Maybe they aren't always communicated in published writings. Maybe, as one of our essayists shows us, like Cheryl Wall, that they're communicated in the private correspondence between Alice Walker and June Jordan. Maybe fields that we know, like the New Southern Studies, actually have pioneering ideas that are created by someone like Alice Walker, and we limit her to the book The Color Purple that became the movie The Color Purple, but actually she generated this body of work and body of ideas and isn't seen as a kind of pioneer and thinker in that way. So I think if you come away from this volume one meeting some fascinating women, because they're all fascinating, thinking about them as important thinkers and intellectuals, and also having questions, right? Thinking about where are the women? I always tell my students, if you ask the question, like, you don't say, oh, there were no women. Don't let anyone ever tell you about anything. Oh, well, there were no women. Like, you know, the women, they weren't thinking. Like, people think. People think. People generate ideas. And so instead of saying, oh, why were there no women, just say, where were they? Right? Where do I have to look for them? Where are they expressing their ideas? Mm-hmm. And that's what we hope to do with the volume. So thank you.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Barbara Savage. Barbara is the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought and Professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of Your Spirits Walk Beside Us, The Politics of Black Religion, Harvard 2008, which offers an historical examination of debates about the public responsibility of black churches and the role of religion in racial ideology. This book won the 2012 Grawemeyer Prize in Religion. Savage is currently at work on an intellectual biography of Professor Mirza Tate, an African-American woman who pioneered in the fields of diplomatic history and international relations during her tenure at Howard University from 1942 to 1977. You may also be interested in knowing that Barbara is a UVA graduate, so we particularly welcome back our alum, Barbara
Savage. Yes, I'll start by saying wahoo wah. I'm very proud it's great to be here and to be on the grounds again. I graduated in 1974, so I was in the first class of women, which I'm proud to say, even though saying I graduated in 1974 does quite age me. But it's nice to be here, and certainly to be here in a very different capacity than when I was first here at 17. So I just want to, I'll sort of continue some of the themes and ideas that Farah has laid out for us here, and just say a little bit about the ways in which we also hoped that this work would model a kind of interdisciplinarity that's always been at the heart of African American studies, mm-hmm. and also a text and work that allowed us to bridge the really important work that had been done on black women's history and the work that had been done on black feminist literary criticism, so that in the same room we have historians and folks who work in literature. And aside from the kind of isolation that Farah described already of doing our own little individual books up in some room in the dark on our own, I think there's a way in which oftentimes the people who are closest to us intellectually are not at our home institutions. Mm-hmm. They are in fields, they're in the fields, but represented at other institutions. Mm-hmm. So this model also allowed us to get people in the room so we could be helpful to one another. And I think it also models a kind of intellectual community and a communal collaborative model that to us felt to us that was the only way this work could have happened. That it, not that it made it better, it was the only way that this volume could have emerged. And as Farah has said, and I'll attest to it, it was an absolute joy, even in the days when we were worried about footnotes and all of the minutiae that goes into the physical production of the book that you see here. It still felt like something that we were all very deeply committed to and that we sacrificed to get the work done. And I would think that for those of you who get the book and who read it, I think you'll be able to see why. Because the women primarily that we talk about in the book in each of the essays, these are very interesting, powerful, different women. And it gave us an opportunity to think also about the relationship between biography and history, mm-hmm. And the ways in which one can look at a life or some part of a person's life and also mine that for arguments and interpretations, not only about the present, the moment in which the person lived or worked or wrote or spoke, but also what is there in that life and in that work that can inform the present moment. And I think that you'll find that for each of the essays, which we also want it very much to be, to reflect the fact that we are all scholars who take our fields very seriously and take our work seriously. Ourselves, we don't take quite so seriously. But we also wanted to produce a volume and work that would be accessible to a general audience and to a lay reader, and also be useful to our students, and whether those students are undergraduates or graduate students. And so I think in the time since the book has been published and been out, which was earlier this year, I think we've all been heartened and surprised to some extent by the eagerness with which the volume has been met, both by folks who teach and by a general readership, that that people are drawn into the narratives of the lives, but also the depth of the ideas that each of these women represents or lays out for us, and the way that we're able to present that. So I just want to say that I think we all felt really emboldened, and also to be doing the work, and to also for ourselves to learn things about women we knew of and knew about, but to have a very different kind of angle on each of them. And I mean, the book involved a number of different generations of scholars, as Farah has said. And since the workshop, because there's always a lag between when you finish the workshop and the writing and when you actually have a book in hand, but we've been actually so pleased that a number of, and not just the folks who are just coming out, you know, in dissertation form or first book, but a number of scholars have gone on to do really great work, and they credit this work and this group with helping them to do their work and to do their work better. And I think that's always, you know, very important to us. And we also are pleased that the book is already being taught and being used actually as almost a one course teaching, in that there are now courses on Black women's intellectual history. In fact, I'm going to teach one in the fall myself. So the spawning of new work and also the reception to it, I think, has been very gratifying to us. But in the end, I think we were about opening up a broader conversation and certainly trying to make our own set of theoretical interventions, both in the field of intellectual history, which has had a history of being among and remaining one of the most kind of closed and traditional fields in history. And so we're expanding that canon, challenging it, and creating a new field, we would like to think, in Black women's intellectual history. And then, as Farah has said, it's expanding our own ideas about where ideas live and who creates them, who constitutes them, and being able to look beyond simply the printed published page as a source for that kind of work. And I think as we think about the book going forward, because books have their own lives too, you do the work and you put it out there, and then they're kind of on their own. But I would say that I think one of the things that I would want to think about in a little while is where these intellectual trajectories might take us for other people who are already doing the work. And is there a way in which at some point we might be able to think about, are there schools of thought within the field of African American women's history? I don't have an answer to that, but that would be interesting to see. And of course there are, and there's work to do there. Mm-hmm. And also the ways in which in doing intellectual history by Black women, are there ideas that Black women are engaged with and engaged around beyond race, certainly including race, but the wide array of topics that do compel and interest Black people more broadly. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about, there would be interesting work to be done on sort of shifting ideas about nature and the environment, including the built environment, but certainly, for a people, African American people and women in particular, of certain generations who were born and bred on land that looks a lot like the land that you see here. Is there a way of thinking about the Great Migration and ideas about nature and the built environment among African-American women, for example? What are the kinds of ideas that black women have about music or law or politics, the media, fashion? You know, just to pick any kind of category and really see this text as the beginning of trying to encourage others and students to, you know, to go forward and do some of that work. And I'll say, you know, just a few quick words. One of the interesting things about doing the text is that, again, some books have already been published by people who are represented here, in particular Sherry Randolph's work on Flo Kennedy in a new biography that just came out in the last few months and that's been receiving a well-deserved amount of attention. But I also sort of met my next book from working on this book, and that I have my essay in here is on a woman, Merz Tate, who was a diplomatic historian at Howard for many years, both an Oxford and Harvard graduate in the 30s and 40s, and an African-American scholar who worked on the history of disarmament, the history of Hawaii, history of railroads as a mechanism for empire, and a black scholar who was interested in colonialism and imperialism, but was not working on domestic racial issues. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so in that way, she, like many women in this volume, they don't necessarily just stretch categories that we have as we think about things like black internationalism or the role of travel in black women's lives, but they actually require us to invent whole new categories of understanding and expanding not just the canon of intellectual history, but our understanding of African American history more broadly. And then the final point I'll make, and I was very pleased last week to be to attend a conference at Chapel Hill. Run by an exciting group of young scholars called the African American Intellectual History Society, and they mounted their first conference. Mm-hmm. And so there, although not focused primarily or exclusively on black women, but also I think a group of scholars who are taking up that banner of certainly expanding our understanding of who's an intellectual, mm-hmm. And why. And I was, so I was just very gratified to also see that and very gratified mm-hmm. to be able to participate in it. Mm-hmm. So there are ways in which I think the seeds that we were able to move towards planting in this book and the lives of the women that we talk about in the book have really touched people and encouraged even more work already. And for that, I think we're very grateful.
Wonderful. Thank you, Barbara. Mm-hmm. And our last speaker is our own Corinne Field, known affectionately at Virginia as Cori Field, who is director of undergraduate programs for women, gender, and sexuality here. Her book, The Struggle for Equal Adulthood, Gender, Race, Age, and the Fight for Citizenship in Antebellum America, was published in 2014 by UNC, University of North Carolina Press. The book recasts the history of American feminism from the Revolution to Reconstruction as a transnational interracial struggle to win women respect as fully realized adults. With Nicholas Surrett, she is co-editor of The Politics of Age in America, Colonial Era to the Present, New York University Press, 2015, a collection of essays exploring how chronological age mattered in the development of citizenship, work, education, and culture. Please join me in welcoming Cori Field.
So I just want to start by thanking the organizers of the festival for having us here, mm-hmm. and Deborah for moderating, and most importantly, the editors of this volume mm-hmm. for creating such a remarkable collective. Mm-hmm. And I just want to underline the significance of the way that the ideas in this book were produced and what that says about intellectual work, because mm-hmm. when we think about syllabi in intellectual history, they're usually arranged with names of authors mm-hmm. that move through time, mm-hmm. you know, a notion that we progress in ideas. And this idea of a sustained collective mm-hmm. where younger people push older people to revise their ideas and older people mentor younger people mm-hmm. is really quite remarkable, and I think grows out of a sustained tradition of Black intellectual thinking that the person I write about in this book thought about deeply in the 19th century. So my chapter is about Frances Harper, who was the leading African-American poet of the 19th century. And she was deeply engaged with the questions of who counts as an intellectual and deeper questions about how you produce ideas within intergenerational communities. So I want to talk a bit about her today. Harper was... writing at a point that was particularly crucial for these questions, which was right after slavery had ended in this country. And you had a generation that had grown old, having been unjustly denied an education, and then younger people coming of age with new opportunities and rights for citizenship. At the same time as this generational issue emerged, social evolutionary thought took off in popularity, not coincidentally, because it offered justifications for arguing that Anglo-Saxons were more mature than anyone of other races and therefore more capable of citizenship, regardless of opportunity. So many leading Black intellectuals intervened in social evolutionary thought by pointing to exceptional cases of intellectual achievement to say, see, with equal opportunity, we can achieve as much as anyone else. Frances Harper took a very different tact, which I think is fascinating. She looked at an older Christian idea of maturity, which takes the life of Christ as the perfect model of a human being, and says that humility, service to others, faith are what constitute true intellectual development, and that these are qualities that can be developed without a formal education, without material reward, without academic credentials. And often, and I think this was the crucial point, that kind of wisdom is developed best by people who are disadvantaged. I mean, not necessarily, right? She's not romanticizing the poor, but she's saying that you can have what later feminists would call a standpoint epistemology that reveals things that more privileged people can't see. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, that was precisely the perspective that America needed as a democracy in the late 19th century, that we needed to recognize the power of these people. And what it has to do with intergenerational communities is that she was really thinking about aging freed women in the South and wanting to recognize their wisdom and a younger generation that was pursuing formal education to maintain their traditions. So I want to point to one moment in particular. First, I'll give you a few details on Harper. So she was born in 1825. To free parents in Baltimore. She was orphaned by the age of three and raised by her uncle, the educator William Watkins. She was one of the best educated African-American women of the time. In 1845, she published her first book of poems, Forest Leaves. 9 years later, she started work as an abolitionist lecturer for the State Anti-Slavery Society of Maine and released her second book, Poems on Miscellaneous Subjects, which really established her reputation as a leading poet and intellectual figure. Now, throughout her life, Harper worked to forge alliances between Black and white activists and bridges between various causes. I want to look at one moment in particular, which was a very grand meeting of an organization that called itself the National Council of Women. And this meeting was held in Washington, D.C. in 1891. Harper found herself by the organizers slated to speak on the topic of, quote, our duty to dependent races. She sat and listened to Alice Fletcher, the white agent for the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, contend that, quote, the white race has led the march of human progress and now owed the Negro fostering care so that he could overcome his stunted growth, transcend the arrest in his development, and take up the duties of citizenship. So Fletcher thus argued that privileged white women should assume public authority because they had a responsibility as highly developed intellects to nurture the childlike members of other races. Okay. So Harper listens to this. I wish that we had a photograph of her face, but we don't. We need to imagine it. And she stood up and responded by delivering a searing critique of the assumption that some races were more intellectually matured than others. She acknowledged that most freed people in the South were illiterate and poor, but insisted that these were not the measures by which intellectual maturity should be judged. She pointed out that the years of enslavement and struggle experienced by black people had developed moral insights unavailable to their more privileged peers, particularly the idea that justice was the right not only of the strong and powerful, but of, quote, all God's poor children. Mm-hmm. This moral understanding that all human beings were equal as children of God was precisely what America needed, Harper argued, since the arrogance of racial caste threatened to undermine both democracy and Christianity. So Harper thus promoted the idea that freed people, though they lacked education and material resources, viewed America from a particular standpoint that conferred intellectual insights of value to the public sphere. Harper's response to Fletcher went beyond validating the particular perspective of rural Southern blacks, however. More fundamentally, she argued that if white women insisted on ranking the best matured minds, then by the Christian faith that most of them professed, they should recognize many black Americans as superior to most whites. Insofar as Christ represented the model of a perfect human being, Harper argued that he paid respect not to the educated and powerful, but to, quote, these little ones that believe in me. So reminding her audience that Christ preached childlike faith as the highest form of knowledge, she contended that many former slaves absorbed this teaching, while white women like Fletcher had cast it aside in their embrace of evolutionary social science and racial hierarchies. Far from being stunted in their growth, Harper insisted many black Americans had developed a way of knowing that more closely conformed to the ideal of Christ. So their powers of discernment were not only morally valid, but, and I think this is the crucial point, intellectually superior. What black people needed from the National Council, therefore, was not fostering care, but a platform from which to speak and respect for their ideas. And these ideas were not, Harper's argument was not only directed at a white audience, but I think also, and quite crucially, at younger African American women, some of whom were beginning to speak out in the voice of a particular generation that had sort of achieved more than their elders. Mm-hmm. And Harper was calling them back to not just honor their foremothers, but really listen to their ideas, even if those ideas were not always published, respected, coming out of universities. So I think, you know, if we want to begin to outline schools of thought, that mm-hmm. in fact, that the process of this book was rooted in a tradition of collective intergenerational work and honor, you know, for ideas across generation. And I just think that's really cool. So thank you.
Thank you, Corey.
Wonderful. Wonderful. This has been just a stimulating set of remarks. I'll make just a few in my capacity as moderator and then open up the floor for discussion. In fact, I think I'll pull from what Corey has said, try to combine a couple of things that Barbara and Farah have said. Frances Harper is a person dear to my heart, and in answer to thinking about Farah's very pointed question, where are the women? That was a question, and I apologize for any seeming self-serving revelation, but I began my career wanting to study the literature of African American women writers, and much of it was not in print. And so when you ask, where are the women, or when Farah asks, where do you go when the foundations turn you down? So these books were not in print, and I, without having a whole lot of experience and did not know what the protocols were in academia, I just proposed that there should be a series on African-American women writers published by Beacon Press, and they bought the idea, and the first volume in the series was Frances Harper's Iola Leroy. And after that came 14 other volumes in train, and it really speaks to what has to happen sometimes when regular channels are not open to you. So these books were, until that moment, by and large, unavailable for teaching, unavailable for reading them. And so we wanted to bring out volumes in affordable paperback editions that could be adopted in classes, and that is precisely what happened. And picking up on Corey's point about the Harper's investments in intergenerational formation and the importance of intergenerational interaction for the advancement of knowledge and a whole range of other things. Harper makes a very interesting move in her novel. It was published in 1892, Iola Leroy. She makes a very interesting move in deciding that there are unlettered black people, the character was named Aunt Linda, who are intellectuals, right? She could not read, but that Harper understood in the choices she made in the novel that the Aunt Lindas of the world, however much illiterate or unlettered, were intellectuals in their own right, and they would have a role to play in the formation of a post-emancipation era for black Americans. And so that's really quite wonderful, one of Harper's other, many of her other contributions. And on the question of childhood, yes, I agree with Corey in the special place Harper reserved for childhood in individual formation. And I think it helps us because now scholarship is catching up. It's not that people haven't studied age before. There have been scholars talking about childhood, and childhood is, as we know, a very late development in human history, right? We didn't always have a concept of childhood. And so thinking about Harper and the foundations, the intellectual foundations in her work, really enables us to ask a series of questions that are particularly critical at this moment. What constitutes a child? Who gets to be a child? How do we identify childhood? When and to what extent is childhood racialized? And we can definitely see the many ways in which it is, and the ways it is with fatal consequences, right? We can think only of Tamir Rice in Ohio, for example. And so where are the women? What are they doing? What constitutes intellectual labor? The final point I will make, drawing from all the speakers, is that we have to be open to receive and to recognize, in cases, reward and acknowledge intellectual labor that's hidden. We all talk about, because black women do a lot of that work, particularly in academic spaces, all of the work you do that doesn't go on the annual report and doesn't go on the CV, right? But we do, all of us do, a whole range of intellectual work that may not necessarily culminate in the publication of a volume, right? But that has been pivotal in the formation and the advancement of ideas. And so this volume then does a great job of helping us understand these critical issues and many, many more. And so I'll open the discussion up to the rest of the audience for your questions and comments.
Mm-hmm. Do you
want to
say anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, Susan.
So thanks, great panel. I'm excited about the book. That's
what we like to hear.
Yes. I haven't actually looked at the table of contents, and I know part of the point is there is no single black woman, there's no black woman or international intergeneration, etc. But I'm still wondering, if the effect of assembling all of these figures, since historians like to periodize things and scholars like to thematize things, Barbara, you sort of began to gesture towards ways that we might organize, sort of schematize these contributions of different schools. And I'm thinking back to Hazel Carby's first book, where one effect of looking at Ida B. Wells was to say, maybe we've been focusing so much on the 20s, but if we look at certain kinds of journalistic intellectual contributions, activist contributions, maybe we should be focusing on turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, is there a through narrative? Did you sort of gesture toward a kind of periodization? Or you know, again, sort of, is there a story that we can tell as a result of putting all these figures together, whether it's chronological or
So I think if there is a through narrative, it is not periodization, except to the extent to which thinking about these thinkers actually upsets traditional periodization, like that there's some ideas that we associate with a particular time that actually emerge much earlier if you take seriously these thinkers. I think that if there is a through line, it might be on what constitutes intellectual work and what informs ideas. So that more than kind of chronological periods, although we start with an essay that looks at enslaved women who are relatively anonymous and how we get their ideas, or from, you know, some of the people here are what we think of more conventionally, like elite women who are highly educated or who operate salons, versus those whose names we might not even know, but who produce a set of ideas that then get articulated later on. So I think if there is a kind of through-line narrative, it's more that. And more often than not, what the women do is they actually upset conventional ways of periodizing spaces. So, you know, for instance, my essay is on the novelist Anne Petrie, who was one of those women who was, you know, Debbie's talking about, that was republished later on through the efforts of people like Debbie and her volume. Yeah, so anyway, Anne Petrie is a novelist who's most well-known, but not particularly well-known, for a novel called The Street that was published in 1946, and that was the first novel by an African-American woman to sell over 1 million copies. And when you insert her, like, that period is often a period of Richard Wright, a period of Ralph Ellison, later on a period of James Baldwin. And you realize she's engaging all of them and arguing with them and pushing forward a certain aesthetic possibility. And including her, you know, there are certain debates that we think of as, like, in African-American literary studies as being Richard Wright is the dominant figure, and James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison are the younger firebrands, and they come along and, you know, they challenge the father figure. And Anne Petrie steps in and says, wait a minute, you know, I've got something to say about this, and I'm challenging all of them. And one of the things that you learn by looking at these texts is that sometimes there are ideas for which we don't even have a name. Like, we can't even appreciate the work that those thinkers were doing until we have evolved enough to come up with concepts. So, for instance, one of the words that's now getting a lot of attention because Hillary Clinton is using it is intersectional analysis, right? And intersectionality, the concept comes from Black feminist thought. It's given a name by a Black woman thinker. Like, Kim Crenshaw names it. And, you know, it's a concept that Black women thinkers are dealing with for a long time. Kim names it sometime in the late 80s, early 90s. Now that we have it, you go back and you read Anne Petrie and you're like, oh, she was doing intersectional work then. She was asking, how are my characters informed, their life experiences not only informed by their race, but also by their gender.
And their
also
class.
By their class, importantly, all together, right? And now we are sophisticated enough as thinkers to be able to read that book in a different way. So I think that's what the through line is, right? How do they challenge what we've received, what we think we know? I thought I knew Frances Harper. I wrote my college thesis on Frances Harper. My first published article was on Frances Harper. I thought I knew Frances Harper until I read Corey's work. And she opened new dimensions that I had never seen in years of reading Frances Harper. Right? So I think that's what, that's the through line.
If I could just follow up there on Petrie, because I think what we're talking about here, when the foundations can perceive the significance of what you're doing, the importance of what you're doing, that is really an issue of value, right? Because when we talk about Black women's intellectual history and Black women's intellectual labor, we really are talking fundamentally about how we value. And reading these works together forces a transvaluation of our of a whole range of things, including what we perceive to be and can identify as intellectual history. But on the question of Anne Petrie, when the series began at Beacon, and Petrie was in the dustbin, all right? We bring the book out. They pretty much gave us the copyright. No problem. Here, go. You want to do that? Have at it. Well, as soon as the reprint began to sell and sell and sell, they took the copyright back. And so the street, which began in the Beacon series, is no longer in the Beacon series because Harper and Row took back the copyright that they pretty much gave me at the start. Oh, you want that? Here. Have at it. And so it's really very interesting how these things go. And for the students in the room, I see some Woodson fellows because they hear me making this point all the time. The important thing to do is you do the work. And you do the work that drives you. You do the work you feel you must do. You do the work not for recognition or acclaim. You do the work because you think it needs to be done. And sometimes the world will catch up. And even if it doesn't, well, the work is its reason for being. Absolutely. Any other questions or comments? Oh, I should. They told me to be mindful of
the
clock.
We're good. It's only 1 o'clock.
Okay, good. O'clock. Yeah. Other questions?
Can I say? I'll say something.
Oh, yes, Barbara. Mm-hmm.
Spill of water and to fill of water a little bit, and just to say something also about what I think what we learned. Or this hidden intellectual labor kind of feeds into this, but also. The working on the book allowed us to think about the sites for Black intellectual work, and also for me in doing the work on Murs Tate, to think about intellectual work in Black institutions like Howard University, where Professor Murs Tate lived and worked for decades and decades, and not unlike the attention to, as Farrah was lining out thinking about Petrie being overshadowed by the attention to Black male intellectuals, certainly physically to be in a space like Howard University for so many decades at the same time that the titans of Black intellectual life, so-called, were also there, whether we're talking about E. Franklin Frazier, Ralph Bunche, a whole long list, Rayford Logan, a whole long list of better known and well-known Black intellectuals, but to be a woman, to be the only woman for a very long time and to be laboring in that space, and also then at the same time not to be doing work on African Americans, but doing the work that drove her and drove her own interests, that I think that there is a way in which this will also require us to think more broadly about our understanding of what it means to be a Black scholar. Tate is unusual in this volume because she is the only PhD earned subject here, because she was very fortunate to be one of the few Black women to earn the doctorate and to actually then be able to get a job in an academic institution, extraordinarily rare. But it does then still open, a way into thinking about the role of Black scholarship for those who are able to do their work in that venue, and to really broaden that out as well. Because I think part of our impetus for doing this work were a couple of volumes that had been published, one called Toward a History of Women, which included no Black people, and work, very prominent work that was done on Black intellectual history that included no Black women, but only Black men, and so that those were real incentives to really complicate all of that and to try to bring it together and then send it out again. So I just wanted to add that. So.
Wonderful.
Corey, you want to say anything?
I think we have another question.
Oh, good.
It's not really a question. I just wanted to thank you all. It's been so interesting to hear your work.
Thank you.
The individual essays, if I might say also, I see you've been taking notes, so you're kind of like I am, but I think you'll also find there's a great deal of information in both the introduction and in the essays themselves if you're interested in going off on your own tangents or filling in what we may or may not know. Mm-hmm. And again, because the essays are written with that, in mind, so it really, I think, should be useful and helpful in that way. Yeah.
Yes, and then Laura, you had it? Yeah,
go ahead. I just wanted to say that, this is wonderful, and congratulations, and thank you. And I'm thinking, as you're talking, how Shonda Rhimes would ask about diversity and what she does, all the programs, she said, you know, I hate the word diversity.
Good.
What I'm doing is I'm normalizing the experience of these people so that you can actually see what America is.
Right. Yes.
And so clearly you all are normalizing Black women as intellectuals.
Yes.
And that's such a great word, normalize.
Right, right.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your work so much. But I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that it's true, right? Like, so even I'll go back to Petrie because she's one of my favorite things to talk about. But, you know, she's sort of like, remember those things, Where's Waldo? In the 1940s, she's sort of everywhere, right? And she's at the American Negro Theater, and she knows she wants to be a writer, but she has something to learn from the young actors there. And who are the young actors there talking about radical Black theater? It's Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier and, you know, Ruby Dee. And, you know, these are the people she's learning about theories of the theater from them. She's taking a writing class with a white woman professor, writer, who is holding a very competitive writing workshop at Columbia University, who becomes a major mentor and actually encourages her not only to write novels, but to write her ideas about aesthetics and invite her to publish. So she's engaged in all these conversations that we sort of all know, and yet we don't know that she's there, right? But if we go back and we just look at what was there, there she is, right? It's normalizing it.
And as much as I was blown away by, you know, I discovered the street.
Yeah.
I was in college and, you know, thanks to Deborah, it was beginning to get out.
Right.
But when you read the narrative,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right.
It's, wow. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's her masterpiece, I think.
Masterpiece.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
It's her masterpiece that was overshadowed by Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she really had it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it speaks to, Lori, I want to get you in. It also speaks to a point Barbara made earlier. When Petrie wrote that book, people began to talk in general about raceless novels, that Petrie isn't writing about Black people. Yeah, which is insane because now our understandings of whiteness as raced, clearly, have come along. But again, we think about the expansive mind of a figure like Petrie, really not, who can't be shoehorned into this whole protest aesthetic of the 40s, who can't simply be shoehorned here, there, or anywhere else. Lori. Mm-hmm.
Oh, first of all, thank you. This was terrific. And I have a really general question that follows, in some sense, from Deborah's comments about the Beacon Press series, but also from the account of going to the NAH and so forth. And I'm interested in your experiences of getting this volume published, and then more generally about where the sites are today. I mean, I can think at different levels where you think about broad popular publishing and the accounts of all of the books that we've never come to light, if Toni Morrison hadn't been editing.
Right.
You think about disciplines, political theory and philosophy, which are the worlds I know, notorious in terms of the so-called, you know, the peer review process at the academic level, and also the disappearance, I think, of some of the smaller feminist collective, you know, publishing undertakings, enterprises.
Yeah.
And so if you could speak a little bit about the contemporary climate for publishing work on the intellectual history of Black women.
I'll just say something, and Farah can augment that. I think we were very fortunate to have support from the University of North Carolina Press from the very beginning of this project, both through Chuck Grinch, who's an editor there, and certainly Pat Sullivan and Waldo Martin, who edit a longstanding series there, the John Hope Franklin series. And also because of UNC's traditional and historic role publishing African American history from the 1940s forward. And I always give them much credit for that. So in particular, I think we were very fortunate to have their support. And I think as soon as we were able to describe to them what we were doing and who was involved, the kind of people involved, and the range of what we were trying to do, they immediately saw the importance of the kind of work that we were trying to imagine. So we were really lucky in that way. But on the broader, I'll let you kind of address the broader question about interest in publishing about sort of in African American history and beyond, because we're also hoping that this will open a way so that when someone goes up to a publisher at a conference and tries to pitch a book about a black woman who no one has ever heard of, and why that might be important and why someone might be interested in reading it and or buying it, that this might make it easier in some ways, you know, for that to happen.
Yeah. So, yes, I mean, I think we're very fortunate to have the UNC Press and the history and the involvement of some of the people who were part of the volume who had also worked with UNC Press before. That's the earlier volumes, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, two things you said are evident in that sort of genealogy that I gave in the beginning, because, you know, a small independent press run by feminists like Kitchen Table Press publishes those anthologies. Toni Cade, not the black woman, but her later works were edited by Toni Morrison, right? I mean, I think there's really exciting work now being done on Morrison as an editor, and the text that, you know, she says, I wasn't in the protest, right? I wasn't marching. I was at Random House, but there was something I could do in that space, and she brought all these books to fore. So I think that it is part of the genealogy. One of the things that's been very interesting about this volume, and I think we should not have been surprised, but we were, has been the interest outside of the academy. We had a nice write-up in Essence magazine when we were first published, and that boosted sales. You know, people were interested. And actually, a lot of the activism that's going on now has also generated its own set of books that need to be read. Mm-hmm. And these are mostly on the internet, they're mostly on blogs, and this book has appeared on so many of those lists in ways that none of us could have anticipated. Mm-hmm. Because when we were starting this, we couldn't have anticipated this moment, right? you know, I'm constantly getting, like, either through Twitter or through Facebook, some list of books that's not just being recommended for graduate students to read, but, you know, young activists should read this, or people interested in this should read this book, these sets of books, and it's included there. And so that's a kind of non-traditional way of kind of distributing the ideas that are here.
And the other thing I'll say about that on the reception side is also, I think the ways, as I said, the way the book takes on a life of its own, and the book actually has sort of, is interested, it has interest among people who are not in the U.S., but an international audience as well. You know, from sort of recent trip to Oxford, that there are folks there who are really engaged by the attempt to broaden the field of intellectual history, because people there have been wanting to do that as well, not necessarily because they're primarily interested in race or African Americans, but them recognizing the narrowness of that field and the ways in which it blows it out. And I also think because the book itself aims towards a diasporic or an international set of actors, that also broadens the appeal in that way. And I don't think we would have, I would not have predicted that either. And I will say that at this conference last week, the African American Intellectual History Society conference, which is kind of a modern manifestation of a collaboration and a collection, because it actually began as a blog. Mm-hmm. Primarily, and then indeed. Blew in and mm-hmm. blew up, mm-hmm. And does extraordinarily serious and important scholarly work through book reviews and blogs, and now through this conference. Mm-hmm. But I do know that a number of folks who are involved with it have also been inspired by this work. Although what they're doing is much more expansive, and very exciting also. So that's good. That's all good. There's a lot of work to do.
Right. Yes. A lot of work
a lot
to
of
do.
Work to do. Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to have to call it here. It's been a wonderful afternoon. Thank you again for your presence. Thank the panelists for their stimulating remarks. And enjoy the rest of the festival.
Okay.
And we'll sign the book.